Thanks, Matt. Yeah, I'd just like to thank the organisers for inviting me to the workshop. It's been really fun. I've had lots of nice discussions with people, so thanks. So this talk is based on these two papers. The archive references are there. And the main part of the talk is from this first one here, and the title is the same as the title of my talk here, and it's joint work with John. So the main aim of the talk is really to try and wonder whether higher order interference, you know, orders 3 and above, give you some sort of consequences for something that I'll describe in a bit more detail now. So as we saw in Howard's talk, you know, the absence of third order interference in conjunction with some other physical principles uniquely specifies quantum theory. So it seems intuitive that, you know, post-quantum interference could imply some post-quantum features. At a first glance, it's kind of not clear what these post-quantum features could be. But for this talk, what we're really going to focus on is whether post-quantum interference gives you some advantage over quantum theory in some information theoretic task. And the information theoretic task we're going to focus on is this thing called a search problem here. So I'm going to roughly give you an intuitive picture of it now and define it a little bit more formally later. So informally, the search problem asks you to find a single marked item from among some list of other items. And in quantum theory, Grover's algorithm is kind of this famous algorithm which solves this problem. The reason it's famous is because it gives you a speed up over all classical algorithms. But the reason that it's interesting for this talk is that Grover's algorithm is optimal for quantum theory. That is, it gives the optimal solution to the search problem for any quantum algorithm up to some sort of constant factors. So this kind of gives us a clear benchmark to aim for, because if we can come up with some way of solving a search problem with post-quantum interference that's faster than Grover's algorithm, then we are sure that we have an advantage over quantum theory. And if we can't, then we know we can't. So I'll talk about the search problem in a little bit more depth. So it essentially says that we have n items, let's say, index 1 to n, and there's some specific marked item, a single one. We're not sure what it is, but we're just going to denote it by x here. And one has access to this thing called an oracle, which essentially is this all-knowing thing, such that when you can pick a certain item, item I, say, and you can ask the oracle, is this the marked item or not? And it can respond yes or no. So you can ask it if some I is x, and it can say yes or no. So one can kind of formalize this oracle as some sort of function, right? So from the list that indexes your list here to a yes or a no. And this function satisfies f of I equal to 1, which is the yes outcome, if and only if I is the marked item. The search problem essentially asks, what's the minimal number of times you have to query this oracle to find the item, the marked item x in the worst case? Classical algorithms require one to query this oracle order n times, which just means that, you know, it's the leading factor is n here. There could be some constants in there, but this is the main kind of scaling with the problem size. So a classical algorithm requires at least this amount of queries to find the marked item. And there exists a quantum algorithm, which is Grover's algorithm, which can find this item and square root the n times. So we get a quadratic speedup over classical theory. And moreover, that this square root n speedup is optimal for quantum theory. There cannot exist an efficient quantum algorithm which can find the marked item in less than this queries in the worst case. So in quantum theory, we have a specific way of formalizing these oracles beyond just this function. So we want a way to kind of access this in some sort of computational circuit. So the way we do it is we use a controlled unitary transformation. So here we have two qubits or two n-level systems here. The first one, item the one labeled I, is the control or the query register. And essentially this is the kind of quantum states corresponding indexing your list. So if I want to query the oracle about item I stick in I here, have some arbitrary state here, and what happens is the oracle essentially input gives you the function evaluated on this input and just gives you that information in the second register here. And it's, you know, this function satisfies the same thing as we saw on the previous slide. It's one if and only if I is the marked item. So the interesting thing here is if we input this state minus, you know, which is this superposition of 0 and 1, we get a kicked back phase. So we stick in minus here, and you can go through all the calculations because this was originally defined on, you know, computational basis states here, and it's linear, it kind of goes through, and you can work out the calculation and find that it's this thing here, which is kicked back, which is some phase, and it depends on the value of the oracle on this specific item. And you can see that this state in this register here is left invariant by this process. So what we do is you just discard that. We can forget about that because all the information in the Oracle is encoded up here. And so in quantum theory, the Oracle is just people, when they talk about the search problem, they essentially just specify this. So it's some unitary transformation in your theory such that when you want to query it with some item here, it puts this phase on here, like so. And the way Grover's algorithm works is that what one does is one prepares some superposition over all of the marked, over all of the items in the list, and you apply this oracle to that original state, and then you apply some other transformations as well, which is the kind of algorithm bit of Grover's algorithm, and then you apply the oracle again, and that same couple of transformations. So at each block, this oracle plus some other transformation moves your initial state a little bit, and when you apply those blocks square root of n times, you're very close to being in the marked item. So Grover's algorithm using this oracle essentially moves a uniform superposition towards this marked item, and then you can detect it with some high probability. So at each query, it kind of moves the state a little bit. Okay, so what I want to do in this talk is I want to study the connection between higher order interference and this search problem in this context of operational theories, which people have talked about in this conference so far. The framework that I'll be using is the one that John introduced yesterday, so this one that kind of places more emphasis on this compositional structure rather than the convexity of the state space. So just to kind of jog everyone's memories, I won't go through it in detail because we've seen it a few times, but an operational theory essentially specifies some set of laboratory devices that can be connected together in different ways to form experiments, and then the theory assigns probabilities to these different experimental outcomes. Okay, and so we've kind of seen in the quantum version of this problem, we need a lot of structure to even begin to talk about this search problem. You know, we need oracles, we need a way to access that information. So we're going to need to impose some structure apart from just the bare operational bones of these theories. So as we saw in John's talk, you know, if you impose some further physical axioms, you find that you have some reversible control transformations and phase kickbacks, which we saw were necessary in the quantum case. So I'm now going to talk about the axioms required to get to that structure so that then we can define oracles and the search problem and then begin to see if post-quantum interference will give you an advantage. Okay, so before we get to that, I first need to define what purity is in this framework. So as John was talking about yesterday, you have these processes which you can think of as some laboratory device with some kind of pointer on the front of it and some input ports and some output ports. You can connect these together to form experiments. And when you use them in the experiment, these pointers on the top of these apparatus come to rest in a number of positions. And so this thing kind of indexes the things that could have happened in an experiment. So here, this EI sub J is the specific process that happened when you used some apparatus in an experiment and you got the pointer position J as the outcome. So there's many different things that could happen and they're indexed by this J, which is the pointer position. So we're going to say a process refines some other process like this if there's a way that I can kind of partition the pointer positions of this one such that when I coarse grain a few of them together, I get something here. I get one of these elements going on here. And I'm going to say a process is pure if it has trivial refinement so that I can't find some other process that gives me more kind of fine-grained information as to what's going on. So you know, an intuitive way of thinking about it is a pure process is one about which we have maximal information in a certain sense. Okay, so our first principle is called purification. And essentially it says that all states can be purified by including some appropriate environment. So here's just some arbitrary state in my theory. And purification says that I can always find some extra system, some system here, and a pure state on these two systems, such that if I use the symbol here to denote discarding that system, I get back to the original thing. So it's the exact same as purification in quantum theory. Given some mixed state, I can always go up a few dimensions and find a pure state such that marginalizing over one of the systems gives me back the original state. Yep.
In your coarse graining, you had a sum.
Yeah.
Does it mean that the outputs are integers or what kind of sum is that?
So it's at this kind of stage, it's in some sense a formal sum. The way we would like properly define it would be, well, if these were, say, states, for example, this sum would formally mean that if I took some effect, which are, you know, some in quantum theory, they'd be the kind of the elements of some POVM and applied them here, the probability that I would get on this side would be the sum of the probabilities I'd get for applying the effect to each of the elements in the summand, and then you define the sums, that process. Okay, so this is the same as in quantum theory. In quantum theory, there's this extra thing. So purification is not just the existence of some pure state in a larger system. It also says that if we have two pure states on the same larger system, such that, you know, discarding this system gives me the same state here, so they have the same marginals in some sense. So these two things will be purifications of the same state. And if that happens, I demand that these two pure states are connected by a reversible transformation on this environment system. Okay? So the next principle is purity preservation. Essentially says that if we have some pure processes like this, then their composite is also pure. So essentially this kind of says that if in very, very roughly, if I have maximum information about this, maximum information about each of the constituent parts, then I have maximal information about their composite, their whole thing going on. So composition preserves purity in some sense. Okay, and the last one is called strong symmetry. This says that if I have two sets of perfectly distinguishable pure states, so by perfectly distinguishable, I mean number one in what Matt was talking about earlier in the ideal case, that is, you know, there exists some measurement that can distinguish all these states in a single shot. There exists some possibly different measurement that can distinguish all these states in a single shot. It says that for any two such sets of states, there exists some reversible transformation such that if I apply it to one of these states, I get to the other one. And this should be true for all entries of these things here. So if you want a quantum example, this is essentially, if you think about the computational basis states of a qubit and the plus minus states, the Hadamard is a transformation which maps you from 0 to plus and 1 to minus. This is essentially what that boils down to in a more general theory. So essentially we're specifying that there's some sort of non-trivial dynamics going on.
I got lost for a sec.
Yeah.
You started by defining purity of states.
Purity of processes.
But purity of processes.
Yeah.
But the definition that I remember had the process being a state. What's the more general definition?
This is the most general definition. And I think maybe the confusion came when I tried to tell you what this sum meant. I restricted the states to make it kind of simpler. But in general, one can have some sort of process which you could think of as being some box with some inputs and some outputs. So a state would be a box with only output wires.
Right.
And one can kind of define what this sum means formally by, I take this process with input wires and output wires, I can plug this into like a larger circuit, and that thing should be a probability. So essentially what this means is when I plug this thing into a circuit, the probability I should get should be the sum of the probabilities that I would have gotten if I put each of these in to that same circuit and added them up.
And all of these have the same set of input and output.
I probably should have said that as well. Yeah, so these two things have to have the same input set and output set. Yeah, is that clear? Is there anything else that was? Okay, so we can talk about higher order interference in the presence of these axioms. And as we've seen Howard define a few days ago, one can do this with projectors. One generally talks about, you know, these Ensel experiments, which you've seen many times, and the existence of higher order interference is kind of witnessed by the fact that the interference pattern we get when all the slits are open isn't some specific linear sum of the interference pattern we get when we close different numbers of the slits. And blocking some slits but leaving some subset I, so if the slits are 1 to n, we leave some subset I open, that essentially corresponds to applying some projector P sub I to this initial state preparation going on here, and that and these projectors, you know, they satisfy this rule here, and we're making this kind of assumption. We're not doing any of the stuff that John talked about in his talk yesterday, because the physical axioms we specified kind of tell us that these things exist in a theory and they're positive, so they're allowed transformations, and so we're going to define higher order interference in terms of these. So I'm going to define the maximal order of interference as this kind of foreboding looking expression here. Essentially means that this thing here is some identity on some n level system. So we can think of it as leaving all n slits open. You know, it doesn't affect the state if just pass them through. And that the maximal order of interference corresponds to the case when we have equality here with these, you know, projectors. And this term here essentially just compensates for the fact that we've overcounted in overlapping some of the slits and stuff. So in the situation where we restrict the number of slits to one higher than the order of interference, we get back to the standard alternating sum, which most people have defined this week. And the specific quantum case of this definition here corresponds to this thing here, which is that, you know, the identity operator on some n-level quantum system can be decomposed like this. So this term here, P sub ij, essentially is the operator that, given some n by n density matrix, sends all elements except for the ii, the jj, the ij, and the ji terms to zero. So it kind of projects onto that sub matrix there. And this thing here is the projector which sends all elements of a density matrix apart from the ii term to zero. And you can just do some kind of simple counting argument to see that, you know, if we apply this to some n by n density matrix, then it's the same as applying the identity. Okay, and this is essentially the reason why we only have to go up to pairs of paths here is because quantum theory has second order interference, but no higher. Okay, so as John mentioned in his talk yesterday, the physical axioms that I've introduced so far imply that in any theory, reversible control transformations must exist. That essentially says that this transformation here, so given some set of reversible transformations T, there exists some big transformation here, which I'm going to call the control, such that if I put in some set of distinguishable states on top, on this system here is going to be called the control system, I get a corresponding transformation applied to this bottom system. Moreover, this transformation is reversible. So it's kind of like the standard, the generalization of, like, say, a controlled knot in quantum theory, for example. And if we make these set of transformations, we pick them so that they depend not only on the thing I'm going to query here, but also on some, you know, specific function which encodes the search problem, then this thing essentially corresponds to an oracle, right? If I want to determine if item I is a marked item, I stick it in here, and then depending on which transformation is performed, I can get information about that. Okay, and as John mentioned as well, these transformations satisfy a phase kickback mechanism, which says that there exists some state here on this lower system, such that when I stick it in, I get a phase kicked back onto the top control system. And that's essentially the same thing as we saw in the quantum case. You know, we stuck in the minus state, we got a phase kickback, and moreover, the bottom state doesn't change in the process. And this thing here is a phase, which essentially means that, you know, it leaves the measurement statistics of the measurement that distinguishes the control state's invariant. So in the general case, when we have all these physical principles, we can restrict our attention of oracles to these kicked back phases as we did in the quantum case. You know, we discard the system in the same way that we discarded the minus system in the quantum example, and we just get this phase. I should have said that, you know, the phase that's kicked back depends on both the state we input and, you know, the function f, because these transformations depended on f. So essentially, we can restrict attention to these kickback phases, which encode the same information as before. So now that we have this kickback phase in this oracle structure, we need to ask what constraints need to be imposed on this such that it's a proper search oracle, that we don't get weird information about things that we wouldn't expect to get. So the best thing to get some intuition for this is to go back to the quantum case and see what's kind of going on there. So in quantum theory, to query the oracle about, you know, item I, one applies the oracle to this density matrix here. I've kind of gone from the Brann-Ket notation to the density matrix notation. So you apply the oracle to this state here. And so instead of doing that, preparing state I and querying the oracle, what we can do instead is we can prepare the state I by passing some uniform superposition through some nth slit experiment with all but the ith slit closed. So this essentially projects us down to this this state I here. And that's, so essentially we can see that querying the oracle about this state is the same as preparing some uniform superposition and passing it to an nth slit experiment. And we can implement the oracle by kind of placing a type of phase shifter behind slit X, where X again is the marked item. So a kind of picture kind of says 1,000 words. So here we can kind of think of, instead of, you know, preparing state I and sending it into this oracle, well, a kind of physical way of thinking about this is having some uniform superposition here, sending us towards this end slit experiment, blocking all these slits and leaving slit I open, so it projects it down to the I state. And if I isn't the marked item, so if X here is the marked item, this slit here, it doesn't pass through this oracle. And because we can't get any information with the marked item if we query on something that isn't the marked item, so this is kind of this oracle kind of goes away and it's the same as doing that. So instead of defining this oracle in terms of what states you can be queried, you can get the same definition out about defining how this oracle interacts with these projectors, because that's the same as choosing different states to prepare closing and opening different subsets of slits. So here's a kind of nice definition in the quantum case of what a search oracle should do. It says that if you have some sort of projector I that leaves open some subset of slits I, but that the marked item isn't in that subset, like we have here, then the oracle should just leave this projector invariant. Essentially, like the case here, if I isn't the marked item, then nothing happens. This is what this says. And two, we have that this oracle can act non-trivially on those kind of projectors such that the subset of slits that are left open contains the marked item. So it can do something to states that are sent in and passed through that subset of slits. But the interesting thing is that it has to satisfy this commutation relation here for all PI, not just the ones on which X is an element of the subset or on X isn't an element of the subset. This must be always true. And the reason for that is as follows. So essentially says that this requirement, this commutativity, ensures that one cannot gain any information about item I when you query a state that doesn't pass through slit I. So essentially, you know, a state that's, you know, left invariant by some subset of slits left open where, you know, I isn't there. So not only do we not want to get information about the marked item when we don't query with a state that kind of goes to the slit indexed by the marked item, we also don't want to gain information about some other slit that we don't go through. And this commutation relation kind of ensures that, that we can't get any information about something that isn't in this subset of slits. Okay, so this gives us a kind of nice general way to define an oracle in these theories, because we have, you know, this phase kickback and we have this projector structure. So in a general theory, I'm just going to define by fiat a search oracle is some reversible phase transformation, if and only if. It doesn't do that if it leaves the projectors invariant where the marked item isn't in that subset, and it can do something non-trivial in the case where X is in that subset. But it has to always satisfy this commutation relation so that we can't gain information about some kind of slit over here that we didn't query through. Okay, and so we can define now in a more formal sense the problem that we're trying to solve. So given some search oracle and some arbitrary collection of reversible transformations, so these things here, so essentially what we want to do is, if we want to come up with an algorithm for the search problem, we can query the oracle, but we're also allowing ourselves the ability to do some other transformation after we query the oracle. So this is what happens in Grover's algorithm. And so essentially what we do is we query the search oracle, we apply some transformation, then we can query the search oracle again, apply some possibly different transformation. And essentially what we mean is we want to find the minimal k, so the minimal times we have to query this oracle such that, you know, with some high probability, we can find the state after applying all this to be in or close to the marked item for some arbitrary input state. And we also have to, you know, average over all possible marked items, because we don't generally know which one is going to be the case for that specific run. Okay, so the main theorem we have is that in any operational theory which satisfies the principles that I listed at the start, you know, those three principles, such that the theory has a finite maximal order of interference H, so, you know, at level H in Sorkin's hierarchy, the number of queries needed to solve the search problem looks like this. So essentially, it scales with the square root of the size of this list in the same way as quantum theory, but we have this extra constant here on the bottom. So essentially, we don't get a speed up over quantum theory in the search problem. And it's kind of interesting to note this this restriction of finiteness here, because if one doesn't impose this finiteness assumption, as your system size grows, your order of interference could also grow. And so one, there would be no restriction on, you know, the ability of someone to try and encode a really hard computational problem in this growing global parameter. And so it wouldn't be surprising if we get a computational speed up in that situation, because we had this growing thing that could encode a hard problem. So we kind of need this finiteness not to get some sort of redundant, powerful computation that doesn't really make sense. So in the case when we restrict the finite but potentially larger than level 2, we get this is the lower bound.
So it's not equality, it's about that.
Yeah, that's why this omega here. Essentially, so we don't know if we can reach this or not. We just know that if there existed an algorithm, it can't do better than this.
This is low bound, so higher input inference might improve it or not? So it's on the denominator.
If this is some sort of constant, so if the order of interference is 4, for example, a 4 would go here. So it wouldn't increase, it wouldn't give a smaller lower bound up to constants than quantum theory. So up to constants, in some sense, you can think of this as saying, when restricted to the search problem and the axioms that I've imposed, all orders of interference are asymptotically equivalent up to these, you know, constants here.
Is it meaningful to have the H there?
Not really. I just stuck it there so you kind of see the reason why I said it here. So yeah, it's not meaningful at all. The quantum case, you know, when you took off this, in the original quantum case, we had order root n. If you took off the order, there'd be a few constants hanging around in there. So yeah, so this doesn't really need to be there. I just thought it would be illustrative to see that it does make a slight difference. So for example, if we looked at something like maybe the collision problem or other problems where you don't want to see how your performance scales with increasing system size, maybe it's just you want to see how much information you can extract in a fixed number of queries, there could be a slight advantage potentially. But for the case where, you know, you can't quantify how your performance scales with increasing system size or size of this list, then there isn't. Okay. So what I'm going to do is, I'm not going to prove this, I'm just going to give you a kind of sketch of the proof and the kind of intuition for why it should be true in some sense. So to do that, I'm going to restrict from these projectors that we've been talking about to these things called coherence projectors, and this will make the kind of intuition a bit clearer. So in the quantum case, if we look at a Q-trit, so this is the density matrix of a general Q-trit, a projector onto the 0, 1 subspace acts like this. So it projects everything except for things coherently linking to 0, 1, to 0. So here like this. And we have these probability distributions here. Now the coherence projector essentially takes us from this Q-trit and maps up to this thing here. So it sends these probabilities to 0, and what we're left with is only the terms that are the coherences between, say, slit 0 and slit 1, if you want. And one can write down these coherence projectors as some linear combination of the original physical projectors, right? Because this thing, in general, won't be a physical state. So this coherence projector corresponds to this thing here. So applying this thing to your state and then subtracting the case where you sent everything but the 0 thing to 0 and everything but the 1 entry to 0. So they kind of cancel out those two terms. So we can think of the coherence projector as this linear sum. So we can generalize that to some sort of n-level experiment. So here, the coherence projector is just a certain alternating sum of these physical projectors. And if you restrict to the case where, you know, this I has mod 2, which is the quantum case of 2 slits, then we get back to this thing here. Okay, and so doing this, making this change, in some sense, is kind of like a change of basis. We can take our definition of the maximal order of interference H, you know, which involved this identity thing here, and some sort of specific linear combination of projectors with certain factors in front of each projector. And we can substitute the fact that these omegas are linear combinations of P's into that, rearrange things, and we see all the kind of factors in front of them taken into account by the fact that we're summing here. What we get is just that the identity on this n-slit system is exactly the sum of these coherences. So there's no prefactors or anything, we just have this going on here. Okay, so the reason we've done this is that we now take some arbitrary state S and apply this identity thing to it. Because that essentially means it leaves I invariant here, but it projects it onto the coherences of this state. So the, you know, this S sub I is defined as being, you know, this coherence projector applied to that state for that specific I. And in some kind of rough sense, you can think of these SIs as the coherences between the slits and I. So this is essentially what Howard was talking about in his talk 2 days ago. So we have this nice decomposition now in the presence of our axioms and this definition of interference. Okay, and so if we look at so we've defined the oracle, you know, to act on these projectors. We defined it by its interaction with those things. But because our coherence projectors are linear combinations of the projectors, we can just, and this oracle is a linear transformation, we can just pass it through that linear sum, And essentially, we can use the definition on each p sub I to show how it acts on the omega sub I. And essentially, the crucial bit of this is that the oracle can only act non-trivially on parts of the decomposition that are coherently linked to the marked item. And this is what happens in quantum theory as well. So it can only really affect those terms in a decomposition which have an x in this subset that are coherently linked to that marked item. So if we look at the quantum case, just for some intuition, so in quantum theory, the terms coherently linked to x, the ratio of the terms coherently linked to x to the total number of terms in that decomposition scales as 1 on n. So in a certain sense then, in one query of the oracle, so because the coherently linked terms are the only ones the oracle can actually affect, to move the state, that's all it, that those are the only entries that it can affect. But the ratio of the terms that it can affect to the total number of terms goes down pretty rapidly. And this is essentially the reason why there's a lower bound to how far the oracle can move a state in a single query. That's why it takes a few different queries to kind of get you all of the way. But now because we have some sort of higher order inference, it might be kind of intuitive that because we have more terms that are coherently linked to the marked item, we can move one of these states further in a single query. But it turns out that when you do the counting, right, so you look at the terms that are coherently linked to the marked item relative to the total terms, it actually shows the same scaling behavior at n, right? So it's, roughly speaking, an oracle in these operational theories cannot move a state further in one query than in quantum theory. So this is essentially so the kind of intuition for why we may not expect there to be a speed up in the situation. And you can turn these, you know, very intuitive and informal ideas into a formal argument to prove that that there's a quadratic lower bound to all these things. Okay, so as far as the search problem goes, all non-trivial but finite orders of interference are asymptotically equivalent in a certain sense. And an interesting kind of consequence of this work is that essentially what we've done is we've derived the quadratic lower bound to the search problem from simple physical principles. That's essentially, in some sense, some very hand-wavy sense, very similar to derivations of Cyrilson's bound on quantum correlations from some sort of physical principles like, you know, information causality or local orthogonality. And it can, in some sense, be seen as the computational analog of deriving that kind of fundamental bound. And an interesting question would be whether the existence of post-quantum interference compromises the security of certain quantum protocols. So this could be seen as another analog that essentially says that, you know, maybe like 12 years ago, people wondered whether the existence of post-quantum correlations could compromise the security of certain quantum protocols or cryptographic schemes. But John Barrett, Lucian, and Adrian showed that this wasn't the case. If the theories satisfy physical principles, then having post-quantum resources as an eavesdropper doesn't compromise the security. So it's interesting to wonder whether, you know, post-quantum interference or post-quantum dynamics in general allow you to kind of compromise the security of certain protocols. And a potential avenue to check this would be this thing called verification of delegated computation. So in this scenario, we have two people, Alice and Bob. Alice has some very limited quantum hardware, but she wants to perform some quantum computation that might require some universal quantum computer. And Bob has at his disposal a universal quantum computer. So what Alice does is she kind of delegates the required computation to Bob. Bob performs it, sends her back the answer, and then she has the answer to the computation she wanted to perform. But the thing is, she has to trust that Bob hasn't deviated from her specified computation, right? Because it's unclear whether from her limited quantum hardware she can check that Bob actually did the computation he was meant to or cheated. And you can show in quantum theory that actually you can always verify that Bob did what you expected him to do with high probability. So either you can say, yes, Bob didn't do anything here, or with high probability he did something and I'm not gonna look at the result of that computation. But in all these proofs, it's assumed that the only way that Bob can deviate from the specified computation is by applying quantum dynamics, so doing an actual quantum computation. But if higher order interference exists, then from John's talk, we've seen that maybe these higher order phase transformations exist. And so potentially he could, you know, cheat by using these phase transformations that aren't quantum transformations, and that Alice can't detect that. So the existence of post-quantum interference could potentially, you know, compromise the security of certain things, and that will need to be checked as well. Thanks very much.
I suppose you might have hoped that rather than getting the result you did, you got that the speed up was sort of the H, the eighth, so I said,
the power, whatever.
Was that an iteration you started with?
So that's what we essentially thought when we started out this thing. We were slightly surprised when we derived this lower bound.
Right.
So in some sense, it's unclear whether this comes from the physical principles we've imposed or the fact that there is higher order interference.
Right.
But it kind of, because most of the principles we've assumed, so for example, strong symmetry, which essentially says that there exists some non-trivial dynamics, you kind of intuitively think that that would possibly give you more computational power, not less. So it doesn't seem like that should affect really the result that much. And purification, maybe you can drop that and get an advantage, I'm not sure. But we kind of needed those to even set up the problem to begin with. So it's hard to know whether, you know, this lower bound is coming from the principles or the higher order inference or a combination of both. But it's kind of nice, right? So if you think about this verification problem, because it seems intuitive that maybe higher order interference can't give you a speed up, then maybe if Bob tries to cheat and do some sort of computation that you don't think he should do with these higher order transformations, you can't do more computation in the quantum, and so you can't deviate too much from the quantum case, and so you can still kind of verify these computations from and security that would be based on physical principles and all that kind of stuff. So maybe there's a reason why there isn't too much computational advantage, and it ensures that you can still do things like this.
One danger is that the assumptions you've made at the beginning actually sort of
restricts you very close to quantum theory.
Do you know that's not the
so
case?
So we know there's at least two theories that satisfy all these axioms. So quantum theory and real quantum theory,
right,
and pure classical probability theory. So the classical probability theory where you only have pure states, not mixed states, satisfies the axiom. So they may be the only examples, I'm not sure. It at least doesn't restrict you straight back to quantum theory. You know, there's at least a different theory, but I think it gets you pretty close. Yeah.
So, yeah, related to that, and we've spoken about it before at different times, is this purity preservation axiom.
Yeah.
So if the full strength of it were needed for this result, and I guess the main way it comes in is through this Curiello-Stadolo spectrality
to
result.
To get your first
direction. And then if you have spectrality and strong symmetry, you can use the argument in the paper with Marcus and Cosman to get these filters and various other things.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the way we actually did that derivation, which I sketched at the end of my talk, was to show that no higher order interference implies that filters preserve purity. And then using Alfsain and Schultz result, if you have these projections on every face, which you do have, and if the thing is self-dual, or if it satisfies what they call symmetry of transition probabilities, but it turns out to be the same thing, then purity preservation by filters already gets you Jordan algebraic systems.
Mm.
And then you really would be stuck with real complex.
Yeah.
But so I guess the two issues I see for blocking that argument, which would be saying their axioms are so strong you can't have higher order inference, are A, as Karen was pointing out, that our filters pure transformations, because purity preservation is by pure transformations.
Yeah, so if the filters were all pure transformations, then they would, by our axiom of purity preservation, preserve all pure states.
Or taking the multiples.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether I suspect they are pure, actually.
I don't think it follows from the axioms that they have to be pure. Because, for example, in quantum theory, there are filters that aren't pure, for example.
There are projections that aren't pure.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're filters.
They're not complemented in the right way or something?
Yeah.
Well, so if sums of...
Now, maybe you don't need the filters. What's the definition of filter?
So it may be the case, but I thought about it yesterday, and I'm not sure that we immediately get it.
No, but if you really need all pure transformations, then what I'm calling filters are still, you have them, right? Just from our first two axes.
Yes, you have them. Yeah.
They would have to preserve purity, and you'd have Jordan. So
we don't know. So if they were pure, then they have to.
Yeah. So you either have to show that they're not pure.
They're not pure, or
that actually transformations, if you look back at where everything comes from, you don't actually need the purity preservation for all transformations, just for maybe, as you were saying, products of states.
In our derivation of the kind of existence of these reversible control transformations, we don't need the full purity preservation axiom, just the fact that product of pure states are pure.
But what do Kirbel and Scott
So they need? They seem to do need full purity preservation to get your first two axioms. As to whether it's definitely necessary is unclear. I haven't read their paper in a while, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But so it'd be interesting to check that, number one, and number two, to see if our axioms do imply that all filters are pure. So one of those, so I guess at this stage it's unclear, but if you could show that all filters are pure, then you'd essentially rule out higher order interference by fiat, but maybe it's not the case that all filters are necessarily pure in theory satisfying these axioms. So I guess, you maybe need to check those things. It would be nice to kind of reduce the amount of axioms we need to get
the
result.
Well, you might be able to reduce the amount of axioms and still get a result.
Something similar. So essentially our kind of derivation of the lower bound really only requires your first two axioms, right? Because if you kind of accept that oracles should just be phase transformations that satisfy our definition of a search oracle, then to get the lower bound, all you need is that you have a projective system. So we don't need purity preservation stuff to get a result once you kind of grant that oracles have this certain property, like a certain structure. So I think you could probably weaken our assumptions to get the whole lot of things.
Yeah, I was also curious if a purification is somehow used directly, or if you just use it like as a means to get this other postulate.
Yeah, so we essentially only use purification to get your first two postulates.
Okay.
And the reason why we kind of went through via that route instead of just assuming your first two postulates is because we also wanted these reversible control transformations with phase kickback, so we can kind of say we have sufficient structure to even talk about the problem. Mm-hmm. One could just kind of define a search oracle by a phase transformation and then use your first two axioms and you get our result. But if you want the whole lot, it seems like at least at the moment you may need purification.
And what about other problems like Shor's algorithm or something like that? Is there any sense that you might do better there? Or?
Well, I guess Shor's algorithm is a polynomial time algorithm, so it's efficient already. So at most you could be...
You might still get some beta, though.
Yeah. This is true. So I mean, as I briefly mentioned in the talk, this appearance of this 1 over h in the lower bound.
Yeah.
So if you looked at different kind of oracle problems that didn't ask for how many queries do you need as the problem size grows, but just in one query, how much information about this function can you extract? Maybe theories with higher order interference can beat quantum theory in the way quantum theory can beat classical theory. So in a single query, a quantum computer can extract information about both, say, fi and fj at the same time, so it can extract information about fi xor fj, whereas on a classical computer using the same algorithm, it can only extract information about fi, let's say. So in one query, quantum can do better than classical.
You think maybe also go...
Potentially a third order interference theory could get information about fi plus fj plus fk in a single query, perhaps.
Right.
Or some sort of more global information about the function than quantum theory could get in a single query. That would be my intuition, I guess.
Nice
to have an example. You just said that Shor's algorithm is polynomial time.
Yeah.
Isn't order n
so
polynomial
it's slightly, okay, so maybe confusing. So this is an oracle problem. So essentially it means that we have this, box called an oracle that, encodes some hard problem that we want to find the answer to, and we can ask the oracle, is this the answer or is this the answer? And so we kind of quantify our performance based on terms of how many times we need to ask the oracle a question. And that's different from the standard efficient polynomial time quantum algorithm. So Shor's algorithm, there isn't really an oracle. What one essentially has input is some sort of number, and you want to determine, is this a factorization or is this a factor? And you just do this algorithm, and at the end, you determine it with high probability. and there's no mention to oracles. So polynomial there refers to the number, the size of your circuits and how they grow with growing problem size, whereas this asks how does your number of queries grow with growing problem size. So it's a slightly different computational setup.
Can I make one more comment about that? So if you were to like compute, like you actually had a circuit instead of this oracle, but you had kept your circuit in a black box, you would probably present these n alternatives as a string of log to the base 2n bits. And that would sort of be the problem size from the point of view of standard computer science. And so this is really saying, well, we can query 2 to the n over 2 queries instead of, you know, instead of 2 to the n queries classically. So the square root just becomes an exponential factor, but it doesn't get you the polynomial.
So I guess n here is some exponential.
But the other contrast with like Shor's algorithm, of course, is that Shor's is a circuit algorithm, and so you would need, well, I guess maybe you have some assumptions about composite systems in there.
In constructing
the phase kickback, maybe.
No, we don't. So the reason how we get around that is just essentially we always stick two states in, so that we never really define this action on some sort of like partite thing or some big circuit like this where it could potentially deviate from this. But in the situation,
at least act on two states at a time. Two systems.
So in deriving this, the only assumption about composites we make is that the composite of two pure states is pure. But we don't assume commographic locality or anything like that.
But so you would have to decide what counts as a circuit size, which is something you don't have to really deal with in the oracle question, because you just ask how many times do I apply the oracle? It's any transformation in between.
Yeah. So in that situation, what one would generally do is one would specify some sort of gate set from which you could build your circuits. And you kind of specify that by field at the start and say, I can only build poly-sized circuits out of these specified gates that are in some sense uniform. And in that situation, to get some nice bounds, you probably would need to assume tomographic locality and all this stuff.
But you've also done some work in circuit models. GPT circuit.
So I did, in the paper with John Barrett, we just assumed tomographic locality, and we define circuits. You know, by we can build a circuit from some finite gate set, and this gate set has to satisfy uniformity conditions. And then, given that definition and the existence of tomographic locality, then we get a bound on the computation that's the same as the best known bound on the class of problems a quantum computer can solve efficiently.
So I'm trying to understand your comment. Are you saying that the input would just be a number n?
Well, small n.
Well, this number, the range that I goes through. And then the output is a particular
integer. Exactly.
But to input the number n, you only need log n bits.
Computer science is weird.
Just the inputting the end is pretty. It seems pretty tame. But I had another. So in some talk that was given somewhere and never written down, apparently with the transparencies exist. David Meyer claimed that you would get some sort of exponential speed up. Are you familiar with this claim?
So Howard has told me a bit about this.
He just emailed us the transparency.
Okay.
but maybe it's a different one, because I don't think he was talking about exponential speed up.
Well,
he had a function from Z3 to Z3, and...
Z3. Okay.
Well, maybe this is different.
I'm not sure it was exponential, but since no one seems to pay any attention to anything that's less than exponential, obviously there's no practical computer program.
Well, this whole field.
If you could drive something down from order n to the fifth to n cubed, that would be a huge improvement. But never mind then. But
So since no one pays any attention, I assumed that when he said it was a speed up, it would be exponential, but I don't know that for sure.
I think it was, well, in this simple case, it was more that, I think it was sort of a hand-wavy argument that it involved sort of three-slit type interference, but he had a quantum algorithm for, you know, computing maybe the sum of three Z3, sum of function from Z3 to Z3 over all inputs, where the sum is in Z3. And I forget what the exact deal was, but classically you need three queries.
By Z3 you mean Z cross Z. Or you just mean?
I think it's a set.
You mean integers mod three?
Yes, the ring integers mod three.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think classically you need three queries. Maybe he had a quantum algorithm with two queries, and then he sort of had an argument that, well, if you weren't constrained to have these by the sum rule, the order two sum rule, then so the order two sum rule was converted basically into a statement that his algorithm would be useless with one query. But if it didn't hold, then it might not be useless.
I guess,
that's a pretty weak statement.
So the improvement is from three queries.
Two queries, one query, two queries, but then you hope to bootstrap this. Just, I mean, this is how quantum computing started, right? With one query instead of two, to get.
Deutsch-Joseph.
In fact, when Deutsch originally wrote it, it was you could do it with one query, and half the time you'd get the answer, and half the time it would say fail, right? And then somebody realized that you can make it work all the time to get the parity with one query. And then that was the beginning of the whole procedure.
Yeah.
Even though it turns out that there isn't a scaling efficient quantum algorithm for parity itself.
Yeah. So I guess maybe the occurrence of H in here, if you would fix the problem size you asked in a single query, could you gain more information than on a quantum computer? Maybe you can leverage this argument and construct an algorithm such that because of the H's here, you can do it slightly better than quantum theory. You can reduce the number of queries to get the same information or something like this.
So are you assuming that the only thing you ever do with the oracle is this phase kickback?
Like, yeah.
Could there be an advantage to actually making some non-trivial use of the target?
Yeah. So this is something we thought about as well. So we make this assumption here because, you know, this phase encodes the same information, so we just discard this. But one could, like, if one wanted, there could be some sort of, instead of inputting a state here, you could plug this into a larger circuit, like a comb or something like that. Maybe you can use that to get an advantage. And this is why I kind of, where's it gone? Yeah, this is why I wrote specifically the problem that I wanted to solve in this case. But you could not solve this problem and solve that more general one where you need to plug this into a larger circuit and maybe you get a speed up there. Maybe the lack of topographic locality would give you some sort of more global parameters in which you could store information, you could extract those in certain ways, maybe. So perhaps, but we kind of restrict it to the situation of this oracle or this phase transformation, because it's exactly the quantum problem. And so we just wanted to consider the exact same problem in this specific work. But it would be interesting to try and generalize that.
All right.
Okay.
Just in time.
Yeah. People may start drifting away, so we shouldn't miss an opportunity to thank you and Michael for organizing the conference. I think very enjoyable.